Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 11th of August. This hour of the program, David Cameron, in a statement before the House of Commons, said most recently that the whole country of Britain has been shocked by the most appalling scenes of people looting, violence, vandalizing, and thieving. He says, we have seen houses, offices, and shops raided and torched, police officers assaulted, and fire crews attacked as they tried to put out fires, people robbing others while they lie injured and bleeding in the street, and even three innocent people being deliberately run over and killed in Birmingham. Mr. Speaker, he said, we cannot put up with this in our country. This has been described as a combination of economic despair, racial tension, and thuggery. We'll talk more about why it is happening and if there are any common themes to flash mobs that have taken place in Milwaukee, Philadelphia, Chicago, and other U.S. cities in the recent last couple weeks. Our guest has a very interesting background. His name is Professor John Bostad, and he is a professor of history at the University of Tennessee. He teaches graduate and undergraduate courses on modern Britain and Ireland and on riots and revolutions in Western Europe and the United States. His book and articles on riots have been widely cited in studies of Russian, Dutch, German, Japanese, and Indian, as well as British and American history. He is the author of a number of publications, including Riots and Community Politics in England and Wales, 1790 to 1810. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor John Bostad, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, I'm delighted.
Would you also say that this is a combination of economic despair, racial tension, and thuggery?
Yeah, I don't think the racial tension has been that much of a factor, although it's a factor in their general place in society. I think that I think one key phrase that helps us understand it is that the rioting is the work of an excluded underclass. But before I go into that, how about if I just outline what has happened in London?
Sure.
Okay. First of all, the triggering event was Thursday night a week ago. A man named Duggan, age 29, father of four, was riding in a cab, which was stopped by the police. They had been following him and trying to arrest him or something. His neighbors said they'd been harassing him. Apparently, two shots were fired, and he was dead. He was shot in the head. Later, the gun found at the scene was a gun that he apparently had and dropped. The police apparently shot because the policeman felt he was threatened, but Duggan himself never fired a shot. So those are all the details. The neighbors and his family was a leader, and the neighbors then organized a vigil outside the police station to call for justice for the family, not knowing what they meant, just police, tell us what's happened. Justify yourselves. Interestingly enough, that went on for 2 days. Then on Saturday night, rioting began when the police were facing a crowd in the street. A girl, 16-year-old girl, threw a rock at the police. The police stormed her and beat on her with their shields. They're not armed, typically, but they beat on her with their shields, and at that point, the crowd just breaks out in anger. It attacks the police station, and then it starts attacking the shopping street. The British call this High Street. We'd call it downtown, the shopping street, and starts attacking. Then, another significant thing, they set a police car on fire, and the picture of that police car burning is tweeted 100 times, and that sends this message of anger all over London, at least. It was like the Rodney King shooting. The video in the Rodney King shooting in L.A. 10 years ago focused people's attention on this issue of police brutality with community. And so it aroused a lot of people who had been thinking about it. And then when another episode, so you get people's attention focused and feeling like they have the same feelings about a problem, and then another episode, triggers off an explosion. So that's what's happening. And people were saying about, when they tweeted about the burning of the car and the initial stage of the riot, they said three interesting things. One, we want justice against the police. Two, come to Tottenham and riot. Three, get yourself a free TV. So there's a whole mixture of motives in there. Mm-hmm. The rioting went on for the next night, Sunday night, it went on in Tottenham, North, which is in North London, a section of North London, spread to a neighboring section, and then it gradually spread all to many places all in London. So let's say a dozen, not in the very center of London, but in the towns that make up Greater London. And then on Monday night, it spread to other cities, Birmingham, Bristol, Liverpool, Gloucester, Nottingham, and so on, just sort of about eight other cities. In some of these cases, again, police arrests provoked crowd anger. And in Birmingham, on Tuesday night, a particularly tragic thing took place. Three Asian youths were standing out on the street guarding their neighborhood, as other people had started to do. And these three young men, were hit by a speeding car, which allegedly was driven by, quote, a rioter. And two brothers died, and that, of course, deepens everybody's sadness and shock and horror. And their family eloquently appealed for calm, don't riot in revenge for this. And that may have worked, because Birmingham has had riots recently, both in the 80s and more recently, but it seems to have remained quiet. Manchester had a fierce riot in the downtown on Monday night and a huge fire and so on. In London, a family's furniture store, big furniture store, they had kept going for five generations of the family, was burned down. They said, oh, here's our whole lifetime's work gone. Mm-hmm. So that is roughly, those are the most important events, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. And let's go back to the incidents of, I heard one gentleman from the neighborhood where Duggan was killed saying that he had been the victim, Duggan, of a lot of racial profiling. He'd been stopped by the police frequently, yep. That many people in that community had been stopped by the police as well. Can you talk more about that? Were their claims justified that there'd been a lot of racial profiling in that community and people were profiled who were pretty upstanding citizens? They were just down on their luck.
Yeah. I think several things. First of all, I don't think we may never know unless we can really, historians may interview neighbors and come up with specific episodes. I don't think the police would ever agree that. So that's always going to be a little bit controversial, but the neighbors did say he had been harassed. What they said about Duggan, he wasn't a gangster, quote, he had been involved in things, quote, but he never hurt anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one crucial factor that relates to your question is this housing estate, or we'd call it a project, this housing estate where he lived was called Broadwater Farms. That is exactly the housing estate, probably 1,000 people or so live there. That's exactly the housing estate where 25 years ago a riot took place on very similar grounds, which was a woman died of a heart attack while her house was being searched by police. The neighborhood then rose up in anger and rioted, similarly to what's going on last week, and they actually hacked a police constable to death. That was particularly brutal, yeah. And so the point is, the people from that estate, they carry that memory. That's passed on from generation to generation. They carry that memory, that's a milestone in the community, both good and bad, I suppose. And so that's in the background when they say, well, people from Broadwater Estate are always under suspicion and always harassed by the police. So it's that feeling that is as important as the facts.
What about this element that David Cameron made mention of in his speech to the House of Commons, this criminality, and we've seen this in U.S. cities during this summer as well, where people are just totally insensitive to others. He mentioned robbing others while they lie injured and bleeding in the street, people being run over and killed in Milwaukee, people being taken from their cars and beat up for absolutely no apparent reason. It's this mentality that's very hard to understand.
And here, what I think you have to do is feel that rioters are more than one group. First of all, although the rioters are reported as predominantly black, we can see white people being arrested. So they're racially mixed. There doesn't seem to be a specific racial tone in it, as there seems to have been in Milwaukee. Secondly, you hear about sort of perfectly normal citizens, and on the one hand, joining the rioters, but then you hear about the criminal element, and then you hear about youths who are perhaps just seeking teens, and all of these are part of it. Now, as far as the criminality, here's what I think. The people start rioting in the first, after Duggan's death, and then this girl's beating by the police, they start rioting with a feeling of justice, of injustice. That brings the community together and makes the community a victim. And once, my proposition is, once you're a victim, anything is permitted. So the lid is off, and then people really take it revenge. And one girl in the riots said, "We just want to show the rich that we can do anything we want." Mm. So there's definitely resentment. I'm not saying I agree with this. I'm not saying you need to agree with it. But we need to understand what brings people together and motivates them. Can I move on to the flash mobs?
Well, of course.
The new element in this, in English terms, I think, is that you have flash mobs. Now, in the United States, the flash mobs I know about are kind of like pranks. They may gather together in a shopping center and either stand quietly or do something or whatever. In England, they are talking about flash robs, where people will use BlackBerry messengers, which are cheaper than cell phones and supposed to be owned by a third of British teens. They use these BlackBerry messengers to tweet or message or send pictures and get people together. They would say, "There's looting going on 3rd Street." And then once the rioting is going on, they say, "Well, the police are on 10th Street. Let's move to 20th Street." So that's a new phenomenon. And then, of course, that communication spreads it to other towns. But this BlackBerry thing does, once the lid is off in a community, then I think the criminal element comes in and the tweeters start saying, "Come and get yourself a free TV, brother."
Right. Let's talk about the police response to this.
Yeah.
Of course, there's been a lot of debate about this in Parliament. Was it sufficient?
Yeah.
What kind of police response do you have to this kind of violence?
It's very different from the American police response. First of all, but the Metropolitan Police is the oldest police institution in Britain, and it's huge, thousands of men and women. And they had just lost their chief of police and the deputy chief because of this hacking scandal with Rupert Murdoch.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah. So they were being run by an interim chief of police who, at least one newspaper said, didn't appear to have a grip. The prime minister was out of town. Okay, so that's part of the story. Now, what's different about British policing is it is resolutely nonviolent. Most of them don't carry guns, as you can tell by the shooting that started it. Some do carry guns under some circumstances, but most of the British don't carry guns. They have truncheons. Incidentally, they call them batons, which sounds odd to us, but these are truncheons, like a police truncheon, and shields, and those are their weapons. So they face the crowds in lines and try to shove them down the street, keep them out of an area, or break them up. So it's very, very different, and people... An old woman at the end of the first day's rioting said to the police, "Why haven't you done more? Why do something?" And the police sergeant replied, "Ma'am, we're damned if we do and damned if we don't."
Hmm.
And so you can debate police restraint, are the police too brutal? or are they too mild? And I think that damned if you do, damned if you don't captures it, along with their the fact that they're unarmed means that once the rioters outnumber the police, they can really take over a city. And I think Americans would have been American police would have been firing long before now. I think they would have run in the National Guard first, and then they might have run in regular troops like they did in Detroit.
Were there enough police? We kept hearing reports over the last few days from citizens in the community saying, we see no police presence at all.
Exactly. And it's hard to say, but the police rotate. They went on to 12-hour shifts instead of 8-hour shifts, but they do rotate, so you only have a fraction, maybe a quarter, of the police in a force on the ground at any one time. The fact that they're overwhelmed by thousands of rioters reminds us of this important fact, that most of the order in our society is not simply people being held down by force, it's habit. And so when that habit is broken, as I said, when the lid is off, when that habit is broken, all hell breaks loose, because that the normal behaviors that we just take for granted, you know, are broken.
Right.
The prime minister characteristically came back to town all huffing and puffing and like the big bad wolf and said, "We're going to fight fire with fire. We're going to actually get tough." And he proposed three things: tear gas, which had been used in Northern Ireland. Talk about racial. There's a racial element there. Mm-hmm. The Irish are not quite human, according to some British.
Right.
Tear gas, water cannons, which which also sounded very tough and very nasty. And unfortunately, all the British water cannons, all the water cannons they had, were in Northern Ireland.
Oh my gosh!
They weren't ready.
Oh my gosh.
And thirdly, rubber bullets as crowd control. Those have been used a lot. And now there's a debate on Wednesday, yesterday. There's a debate: should we bring this force onto the streets of Britain? Rubber bullets. Imagine. I mean, I can't imagine that issue being raised in the United States.
Right. I know. It's incomprehensible.
Yeah.
Whole different society. We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour to give us an understanding of what's going on in Britain, what the sequence of events were that caused rioting, why you can get from a certain sequence of events to a kind of rioting that doesn't take human beings into consideration, a kind of a mob mentality, additional way that people can organize, which is, you know, these Twitter accounts so that you can gather a lot of people to, as he said, come and riot and get yourself a free television and hurt a lot of people in the process and a lot of property and family business, etc. So we're talking about the response to this, and we have yet to talk more about that underclass that he mentioned, the excluded underclass. Will branch into that as we continue. And we're welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. John Bostead is professor of history at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. One of my favorite cities, I love Knoxville, and author of Riots and Community Politics in England and Wales, 1790-1810. He has written extensively about, a number of issues. His special areas are modern Britain, Ireland, European social and economic history, riots, and revolutions. So he's a perfect analyst for this show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our phone calls with Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Sounds like a very fine guest. I would like to, I don't have any analysis, but I'd like to suggest a number of things. One is, and I did live in Britain for a number of years, that this is a post-Thatcher Britain. There was a tacit social contract which should be between all the classes, where it was a very civil society, violence wasn't used, there were standards of expectations of social conduct, which went from top to bottom. And that was broken during the Thatcher years, and a substantial, and we're not talking about class, but the social contract was violated. A large segment of the population was never really going to go anywhere after that. And the society was also one that was extremely well policed. There literally was someone who we would call a cop on every corner. And one of the things that Thatcher and her successors did was seek efficiencies in policing. So the number of constables on the corner went down dramatically, and essentially a surveillance culture replaced that. So the belief in the society and a commitment to your fellow man really was decreased in Britain, and it became a more violent society, whereas it was a remarkably pacific one for most of the century. I think I've said enough. Thank you.
Thanks, Frank, for the call.
Okay, shall I respond?
Please.
Yeah. Well, Frank, I think you've got a great idea. The post-Thatcher Britain, I think that's right. I think I would find the situation before Thatcher a little more complicated in the sense that it wasn't hunky dory for everybody. That's kind of a national myth, but in fact, for the working classes before Thatcher and all the way back, the working classes were much more mired in their spot. They had much less opportunity, partly because education was selective at both the secondary and the university level, so that very many fewer had a chance to get education and go anywhere. So there was much more, and remember that the working class in Britain is a lot bigger than in the United States. It's more like two-thirds of the population than our third or so. But Thatcher, with her rhetoric particularly, the most famous statement she said is, "I don't believe in such a thing as society." And that really rocks us. That seems brutal. The social contract, yes. She, again, probably more rhetorically, like Reagan, more rhetorically than actually, in terms of dismantling the welfare state and defunding. In fact, they didn't defund that much. But what you talk about in the changes of police, I think, is significant. And I'm not real educated about that, but I think that's a good point. The old system had the police walking the beat, and he knew everybody, literally, from the and he saw them growing up, and he was chatting with them, and so he knew when somebody was going to be in trouble and kept an eye on them and so on and so on. He might be the community problem solver or referee. And now you do have more of a surveillance, more cars. And when a policeman is whizzing through a neighborhood in a car with what you call, that's a good term, the surveillance society, they don't get to know people. And, of course, we've had that in the United States for quite a long time. So I think it has some good points. I'm not sure that the situation before Thatcher was so hunky-dory, but Thatcher, with her rhetoric, and then when the riots came, not accidentally, on her watch in 1981 and 85, she was just breathing fire and cracking down and all the criminals and hoodlums and thugs. And like Cameron today, she's trying to use the violence for her own political ends.
Mm-hmm. And I think it was the Times yesterday that said that the pattern of the current disorder is similar to the last major rioting in London, which you just highlighted.
Yeah, I think that, as in the United States, in many cases in the 60s, something that people don't realize is how far these riots are triggered by clashes between the community and the police. If riots were because people were socially and economically deprived, miserable economically, we'd have riots all day, every day, because there are always lots and lots of people socially and economically deprived. But what changes is an episode of police violence, like the Rodney King video, so egregious that it cannot be ignored. And so the community says, oh, we are now victims. We will rise up. We're justified. And we're going to get the police on their heels. Mm-hmm, so, again, it's a combination of factors. It's not It's not one thing. The riots don't simply grow out of that incident. They grow out of riots have a recipe of factors. And so that's the, when that one episode takes off the lid of normality, then the riot recipe gets cooked.
Thank you, Frank, as always, for your call. Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi.
Unfortunately, part of that normality is that the perpetrators get away with it in Britain, and the real victims of the perpetrators are victimized by the society. I've just read this wonderful article on the recent things by Max Hastings in the Daily Mail of London. And he says, you know, if you try to defend your, and this is before the riots, if you try to defend your home or business from burglars or whatnot, the police are going to crack down on you. And whereas most of the time, the crimes like burglary and theft, car theft, are not even investigated by the police. The criminal class gets away with it. And if you try to crack down on them, why, they consider that unjust. You're changing the rules. You know, you should let us get away with it. And the riots are simply this whole attitude that I can get whatever I want without being rich, without doing work, just being on welfare. I can just go to the store and loot. This is the attitude that goes on. They get away with it in the schools. You complain about the old schools. In the old schools, you had discipline. Yes, many of them were rooted for university, and many were rooted for the working class, which they were. But there were people who could change if they did well on the examinations.
Professor Bosted.
Yeah, I think you're overgeneralizing. If what you say is true, we ought to have rioting all day, every day, because that attitude. If that attitude exists, and I don't think there's always evidence. People say that all the time. Those are mantras that people like Max Hastings repeat. But I don't think there's a whole lot of evidence that people say, I'm on welfare, you owe me this, I can get anything you want. Here's what somebody who works with this excluded underclass says, who works daily with them. They say, working at street level in London for many years, we have become concerned about large groups of young adults creating their own parallel antisocial communities with different rules. And, of course, part of this is gang culture. Drugs are involved. Again, I must emphasize, I'm not sympathizing with the arsonists and the looters. I'm not saying we need to accept their viewpoint. I'm saying we better understand their viewpoint if we want to get a handle on these riots. So that she goes on to say, the individual is responsible for their own survival because the established community is perceived. The established community is perceived to provide nothing. Acquisition of goods through violence is justified in neighborhoods where jungle rules exist. Dog-eat-dog pervades, and the top dog survives the best. And the drug economy provides a parallel subculture which allows money to people for people to buy blackberries at Amazon.com Britain for $60. So we have an excluded underclass both there and here. You had that in Paris in 2005. Again, police killing of two youths in very controversial circumstances triggered rioting for a couple of weeks. The signature of that spate of rioting, a lot of it by immigrant youths in slums, in ghettos around Paris, the signature was burning cars. Mm-hmm. 10,000 cars were burned.
Oh my, was it that many? Wow.
Yeah, and my impression is that I couldn't back this up, and I don't know the facts, but my hypothesis would be, I bet you they were more upscale cars. Because these are people sticking their finger in the eye of respectable people. We don't like it, you know. We don't say, that's fine, do it. We're against looting and arson. Yes, you're right that it victimized people. The furniture store family saw a lifetime's work go up in flames, a huge building. On Main Street, shop after shop, the shopkeepers come out and say, well, there goes a lifetime of work. Yes, they are victimized, but I can't agree that burglary is not investigated by the police, and I can't agree that sentencing is always light. I think in our country, sentencing, this is my own personal opinion, sentencing is so heavy that our prisons have become graduate schools of criminal training. Mm. But that's another subject.
You know, Hugh, thanks for the call. Chris in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I was just wondering about the police response to the usage of social media. Do you know in these sorts of situations where they're using BlackBerry and Twitter to rally people, are the police monitoring this? Or are they, like, responding quickly, or is it taking them a while to catch
on? Certainly, some of them knew how to hack, didn't they?
Yeah. But I think, that's interesting. And here's the deal. This is a little snippet that's come through the news, and it hasn't been verified, but people are saying there's something about the BlackBerry Twitter message that cannot be hacked. Like in the News of the World scandal, they were hacking cell phones.
Huh.
But there's I don't know if this is true or not, that this little BlackBerry messenger is more like a tweet device. Those have been real important in escalating from a neighborhood incident, which might be a few hundred people and, you know, one night of damage, to bringing in thousands of people from all over the city, fueled by injustice, and some of them fueled by simple greed. Yeah, I want a free TV. Yeah, one cell phone store was emptied of cell phones. So, yeah, there's that out there. There's certainly a criminal element. And the police know about this. And this is very striking. It's very interesting. But I'm not sure the police have figured out a way to do with it. So they're trying to figure out, are there some kind of rules that we could apply here? And, of course, one of the rules that we've seen applied in another situation would be curfews. That hasn't been talked about in Britain, as far as I know.
Right.
Be off the streets after 6 o'clock or something.
Yeah. Thanks, Chris, for the call. Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Yes, I have a comment and an observation. I find that for all the saber rattling, you know, by the prime minister, I think he's right on one level. I find it very disturbing that at least when I was growing up, I'm about 60 now. I was taught by my background that your behavior, the measure of your character, is what you do when no one is watching.
Good.
It's the standard of behavior that you maintain for yourself. In other words, you do not give yourself permission to behave in certain ways, regardless of whether you feel you're treated unfairly, regardless of whether, you know, there's anyone watching, regardless of whether you outnumber the police. And that seems to have just totally broken down.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of a social, that people have any kind of, it's like they've gone feral. You know, there's just no inner compass. I don't mean moral compass in like a religious sense. I just mean the standard of behavior you set for yourself. And I guess my observation is I went to visit my family back in Seattle this past summer, and not this summer, but last summer, and there was an incident in a drugstore, and this is a suburb of about 200,000 people. I know it's a huge suburb, but it's like San Jose is to like San Francisco. It's a big suburb, fairly upscale. But a young Hispanic kid runs in, and he's yelling at the one of the drugstore employees. He says, "Some gang guys are chasing me," you know. And I overheard the commotion. And anyway, the police showed up. There were 3 armored personnel carriers filled with police in full body armor, carrying a variety of automatic weapons. And I found it extremely quaint that they're sitting over there debating over whether or not to use water cannon and rubber bullets. It says, our police carry automatic weapons.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call, Professor Bosted.
Well, those are a lot of great observations. I must say, when you were taught that, I kind of grew up the same way. When you were taught that, I would surmise years and years of steady, careful and strong parenting and reinforcement at good schools by good teachers, and then possibly other organizations like church, Boy Scouts, et cetera, et cetera. So they encode these things in you deeply, deeply. These mores, they're mores, and they're social mores. So you're exactly right. Those are all part of a community moral sense, moral compass, and they're also social bonds because they get reinforced. Your friends have parents and schools and churches like yours, and they all reinforce it. I think what we're seeing with these kids is I think they probably don't have that same year after year of steady moral encoding in mm-hmm. many cases. And then that quote that I just read of saying they don't feel themselves to be a part of society. And that's when you said they went feral. Yeah, they do. Yeah, I think that's a good word because they don't feel themselves to be part of the society. What the solution might be, I have no idea.
I don't either. I had a small incident, and it weighs on me because of something that happened to me yesterday, of my purse being stolen out of my backyard about a month ago. And, you know, it's a hassle. You got to get your driver's license, blah, blah, blah. But most of all, it had medications in it that I really need to stay alive.
Yeah.
And yesterday, somebody came up to my house with my driver's license and a credit card and a couple pens that were in the purse and said, you know, there's more stuff over in the alley. And he showed me where it was. So I go over to the alley and there's all my medicine, everything. They just took the money. And it's weighed on me because I'm thinking, did they need food or did they need drugs? And why didn't they think about the fact that I needed that medicine? You know, there's something about not thinking about the other person that's really hard to take.
Oh, yeah. What this worker who's worked with these kids has said is it's dog eat dog out there.
Right. It's just that is very troubling.
It's very troubling. And one of the things that riots do is they shine a spotlight on society. Now, whether there's a solution or not, I'm not saying. But at least riots light up a stage that was previously in the dark. So we see this drama going on over there that we had no idea is there. And the stage is lit up. Right. We watch the actors, and then we say, holy cow. That's tragic. Let me comment on one more thing. This last caller, Bill, said, he said in the Seattle area, the police made a huge show of force with armored cars and automatic weapons. That's a very important point. And sometimes police have effectively used the show of force, and just the rioters don't go any further. They just stop dead. And I think, you know, that's another possibility for keeping order. That may be what happened on Wednesday with all this talk about we're going to fight fire with fire. We're going to really respond. And they were organizing more police on the streets. So at least the presence was there. They had a couple of tanks on the street in London, or tanks or armored cars. They're really more like armored cars. But they had those on the street. So a show of force in the government is saying, we really mean this. Stop.
Right.
So, that is a factor. So you can't just take one factor. It's a recipe. And the police, what the police do is part of the recipe.
All right. So let's go beyond that, because the holy cow is a big holy cow. You got the police to stop further acts of violence. And then what the heck do you do?
Right.
What do you do?
Right.
What should they do?
Yeah. That brings in everything, doesn't it?
Yeah. It does.
I would have to know more about. I would ask some of these youth workers in either charity programs or charity programs. I know there's one in Knoxville that deals with the homeless. They don't simply give people something; they make a contract. They're a very successful, strong quote charity program. They're only charity because we give them money. That's what I mean by charity. They practice tough love, and they say, we will get you a place to live, but you got to observe these rules and you got to live up to obligations. And here they are. And they do get, and so they get people from off the streets into housing. Now, they've succeeded with hundreds of people, not thousands. So I would go out and ask people who have really worked out there. Remember, the biggest thing is these estranged communities that these kids live in are invisible to us. We don't know. We don't know what goes on there. We can't imagine how it works. And until we knew more about it, we'd be clueless. But so I'd go and ask the people who work with them, the social workers, the police possibly, people, observers who know something about what goes on those hidden stages. I'd ask them, what works? Give us individual stories. How do people get out of, drug peddling and gangster stuff? And what what gets them out of that into what we prefer to think of as normal life?
Yeah, a life that has some meaning. I don't know. I don't know the answer. I feel like we all have to take the next 10 minutes and think about it and write our thoughts, but we'll take your phone calls and continue with our conversation in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor John Bosted. He's a professor of history at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, and his special areas are modern Britain, Ireland, European social and economic history, and riots and revolutions. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email, if you would care to use that, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of the program, how the states got their shapes to the people behind the border lines. We interviewed the author for the first book, How the States Got Their Shapes, and this book picks up where the other one dropped off or left off, exploring American history through the lens of its state lines, this time through the colorful and remarkable stories of those who created the shapes. That's hour number two. The riots in Britain this hour, and Jackie is our next caller on the road. Hi, Jackie.
Good morning. I think this is a great program, an important one. I grew up in the United Kingdom. I was born there in 1959. I've lived here since 1998. And I went to one of those comprehensive schools that dealt with all the kids, the ones that we'd done away with the selection programs, the grammar school or comprehensive split had stopped, and everybody went to comprehensive school unless they had, you know, private money to pay for their education. And I was in classrooms, mixed grade classrooms, with up to 36 students for most of the time until I graduated high school. And like most of you, I'm probably, you know, a B-plus or an A student, and I was in class with kids that got an F. Well, when I was a girl, kids that got an F went to respectable working factories that nobody looked down their noses at them. They had a place to be part of the community, to be part of the workforce, to build a future for themselves and their families, without any negative judgment. Today, every job is technical. The work that the people that the F grade, the work for the F grade students, is very, very poor quality work. Even for the production line jobs now, you need to be computer literate. And I think we're sending out of school students that don't feel any opportunity, any means to connect to a future. Doesn't give them the right to throw a brick through a window. Breaks my heart. But I was talking with my husband. I was literally crying watching stuff on the BBC this morning, talking to my husband, who's, you know, got degrees in three different sciences, a smart guy with, you know, reaching the end of his professional life. And he talks about, you know, these kids need to get good grades, stay in school, get good grades, and then they'll have a future. I said, but what if you're not capable of learning? We assume as you know, successful professionals, that everybody's capable of having what we have if they just work a little harder. And I think as a society here and there and everywhere, that the way that technology is such a part of our life from the very beginning of our life, people who aren't capable of learning that, we have to work out a way to make, to respect people who can't live in the world that you and I occupy.
Oh, what a great call. Thank you so much for calling, Jackie. Professor Bosted. Are you there? Professor? Oh, I don't know what happened here. Hello, Professor? Well, Jackie, thank you very much for your call. I hope that he heard your comments, but we all did. And I thank you very much for your perspective and your deep thoughts. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. And are you there now, Professor? He doesn't seem to be here. Hello? I can sort of hear something in the background, but I can't hear him. Hello? At any rate, we'll just take some of your comments until we can reconnect with him. I think she makes a very important point. Let's go next to Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich. You're the guest and the caller right now. Hi.
Wow.
I don't know where it happened to.
An English major.
Which
I, by the parallels between Anthony Burgess's A Clockwork Orange, which was written a long time ago, and the Corova milk bar and Alex is sent up for 14 years in prison, and then he gets out a defenseless person, and two of his old buddies are police officers, and they go after him. And the whole thing is set within this society where the city is governed by a really repressive, totalitarian view of the world. And I was going to ask the professor, my understanding is that Britain is one of the places in the world that has so technologized surveillance, I'm told at least, I don't know for sure, that there are cameras almost everywhere. I mean, public surveillance cameras that make sure that people are being watched, particularly in commercial districts. And I think that creates a sort of want to get back at being watched sort of society, where why else would these essentially ski masks or hoodies be so prominent in the rioting, where these youths are trying to claim through how they dress themselves total anonymity? You cannot watch me. You cannot identify me. And so,
yep.
I'm sorry, Kathleen. That's the English.
No, it's good. That's great. Yeah, no, it's a whole new perspective, Rich. Thank you, Professor. Are you with us?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay. He brought up Clockwork Orange, and
yeah.
It's a good book to makes me
yeah.
want to go read that again.
Yeah.
And this surveillance, the interesting points.
I think he's onto something. I think that's a great notion. And the masks, I think that all fits very nicely. Let me say this: I don't know specifically about surveillance advances, but for 30 years after from 1960 to the mid 90s, Britain felt themselves to be under siege from IRA terrorist bombings, and in a few cases, IRA bombs were set off in pubs or
mm-hmm.
in Harrods one time.
Yes.
Shopping, you know. So that's one reason for all the surveillance. Then when you had this subway, the underground attack about three, four years ago, that just reinforced it. Now Al-Qaeda sticks its nose into London. So that's one reason. I was in London a month ago, and we were looking for waste baskets in the subway, in the underground, and I don't think they had waste baskets because of this thing. It's so easy to drop a bomb in a waste basket. So I think this experience with terrorism has been one element. It's, again, I caution people, don't say it's one thing, it's a combination. But that's part of it, and I think that your talk about the masks is a fascinating insight. I think that might be true. And again, I used the old colloquial phrase, they're poking their finger in the eye of the establishment, and taking what you say about surveillance and the masks, that's almost literally true.
Mm-hmm.
Rioters have some kind of anonymity because there are so many of them, but of course they are also being captured on closed circuit TV. So that is another reason for the mask, is simply practical. I don't want to be identified on these police cameras.
Thank you, Rich, so much for your call. Really interesting calls today. Tony in Janesville, about a minute left. Hi, Tony.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't know if it's a comment or a question, but I think, you know, worldwide with the growing difference in economics between, you know, poor and rich people, he's talking about that being part of the recipe. It'd really be nice to see somebody try and take all of, you know, the anger and the effort that you see from rioters when things, you know, get down to the last thread, and do something about it before that, and, you know, turn that into, you know, a way of a politically charged people that are willing to try and, you know, affect policies and political changes to get what they want instead. And I guess I can take my comment off the air. I just thought it'd be really nice to try and, you know, propel that or make that happen.
Thank you, Tony.
Well, we think that happens in sports, and so, you know, that's organized aggression, and that's good for youths. And I like your point. It could also be that let's take that energy and that anger, let's compete between two communities and see which one can build a better youth center by the youth themselves. you know, let's protect, let's garden, let's do other things in competition. The rioters are, to a considerable degree, testosterone poisoned in that crucial age, 15 to 25. That's a lot of them. So, again, it's not the whole factor, but that's part of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for being with us. You get to London often. You get to Britain often?
Yeah, as often as I can.
Yeah. Well, I love your city, too. Knoxville's a good place. James Agee, one of my all-time favorites. Yeah, it's great. Thank you. Thanks for your insights.
Okay.
Our guest this hour, Professor John Bosted, and he is a professor of history at the University of Tennessee, has written extensively about, a number of issues, including a book that you really want to read right now, don't you? Riots and Community Politics in England and Wales, and get the years here, 1790 to 1810. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for finding this guest, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with a fun conversation, hour number two. I guess we can have fun every now and then. Thanks for listening to this hour. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.